Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. On today's Fresnolandia, we are here with Pablo Orihuela, who is Fresnoland's housing reporter, to talk about a convergence of a lot of different housing topics. And so we just wanted to expound on that today. So welcome to the podcast, Pablo.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So Pablo, start us off by giving us the big picture of what's going on.
Yeah, we're hitting a cliff in terms of federal and state funding coming to a close, and that's been brought on by multiple things. There is the current President Trump administration, which has been slashing a lot of federal programs, among them the Housing and Urban Development Department. There is currently here at the state level the governor, Gavin Newsom, who's been quite aggressive now in trying to solve homelessness, and he's clearly trying to balance that with the fact that the state just narrowly passed a budget overcoming millions of dollars in deficit. And a way to plug in that budget is by cutting a lot of programs, among them some housing programs that places like the city of Fresno use to fund a lot of their homelessness resources.
And a lot of this has been not an entire surprise to local leaders who are in the weeds of addressing homelessness. Housing Authority sounded some alarm. So tell us about some of the known cuts that we're going to see.
Yeah, and we also saw the end of pandemic funding.
Yes.
And so there's some expectation here.
Yeah.
So with the Housing Authority in particular, as I said, the cuts to the Housing and Urban Development Program, which is the program that administers Section 8 or Housing Choice Vouchers for at-risk families, they are staring down the barrel of a 50% cut to funding for that program, which would be a loss of half of the vouchers here at the county level, which the Housing Authority has said would affect about 5,500 vouchers or about 15,000 residents here. The Housing Authority is bracing for cuts at any level, even if it's not the full 50%, which means some families will lose the ability to effectively pay their rent every month.
And this is a program that's already impacted. It has a wait list of around, 10,000 people?
Years long. We spoke to someone for a story that's not out yet that told us they waited over a year for a voucher, were in months in waiting after applying. This is something where even if cuts didn't happen, it is greatly impacted and is always a need for more funding, people would argue.
And just to put the cuts to this in perspective, people who are lower income who qualify for federal housing assistance, there's sort of two paths that they have. They can either get a housing choice voucher, which is basically something that is negotiated with a landlord that goes directly to the landlord, and so the landlord reduces the rent that a person pays in exchange for this voucher. The landlord receives the full rent, it's just not all coming from the tenant. And then the other way that people can get affordable housing is through project-based affordable housing assistance, and that's so far that we know has not had any cuts, correct?
Correct.
Although we know there's been allusions as the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, they've been saying that we're probably gonna see cuts to CDBG, which is a big program that funds affordable housing and also to home. So we know that cuts could be on the horizon, but at this point, the funding that touches how we build affordable housing hasn't been disrupted yet.
That we know of, and just to maybe close the knot on the Housing Authority in particular, what they tell us is they're facing a balancing act between risking fear-mongering or risking keeping people in the dark. They are bracing for cuts at any level, but they have no idea if, say, 50% of those vouchers were cut, if they would go offline overnight, or if it would be a sort of sequential loss of vouchers over time. So they are balancing either talking to residents and letting them know what's coming, with the fact that they also don't know what would be coming. Yeah. It's a very interesting position to be in if you're them.
Yeah. That kind of seems like a theme just throughout this administration, because there's so many possible changes on the horizon, whether
yes.
It's immigration or housing or birthright citizenship. And it's how do you balance telling people what could happen so that they could prepare versus making them live in fear for something that may never materialize.
Even looking at state funding, if you want to maybe move on to that, it's a situation that's constantly evolving. And so you have people that are maybe dispelling different narratives. And because the situation is ever changing, who's to say whether one's wrong or right?
Yeah. Let's humanize this a little bit. Who's going to be affected by the cut to emergency housing vouchers? I know that they're often used in domestic violence situations or getting people off the street. Can you talk about the human impact of this loss of funding?
Yeah. So these are vouchers that go to people who truly face situations that are either they're at risk. They are maybe women or single mothers trying to escape a dangerous situation, sometimes with domestic abuse. And sometimes it's not even a specialized victim like that. It is just someone who cannot afford to pay rent and they just need a couple of extra dollars to make that happen. And what this program does is it essentially covers the part of rent that they cannot pay. And it's not hyperbolic, as the Housing Authority and other housing advocates across the nation have said, to say that the loss of these vouchers would effectively make it so that these people will go over the street overnight.
Yeah. Donnie, how does cuts to emergency housing vouchers, how does that affect the rental market generally?
I do think, and Pablo, I know you've talked a little bit with landlords or people who represent landlords, but landlords do actually very much appreciate the voucher system because
Correct.
There's only so much demand for homes that command a certain type of rent. And so it keeps the landlords whole when they have a voucher. And without a voucher, what they'll have to do is they'll have to increase the market rent so that they can recoup their costs or make the profit that they've envisioned making. And so it can actually decrease the supply of lower income housing stock, which is already incredibly scarce. Our vacancy rates are incredibly low. I don't know what they are off the top of my head, but they remain below 2%, which
is... Yeah, last year it was about 2.8 in 24, so I don't know what it is now for 2025.
They've been hovering around 2 or below 2 that I've seen for the last three, basically as we've left the pandemic.
Yeah.
And 2% is seen nationwide as the standard for a very tight housing market.
Yeah, which Fresno should not be.
Yes, no.
In theory, right?
You know? You would think we see lots of building, but again, most of the building is suburban homes. We're not getting a lot of apartments built in town, and that contributes.
Yeah, before we started recording, we were talking about the filter effect, which is this idea that if you build market rate housing, it eventually will filter down to low-income housing and increase supply for low-income renters. But there's a question as to whether that works here in Fresno. What do you think about that concept as a theory to explain how to increase housing supply here?
It's certainly a concept that you hear from a lot of local elected officials in town, justifying why we need to build more luxury homes, so to speak. Anything above $500,000, in my view, is almost considered a luxury at this point, maybe $600,000. I'm not sure how we break down the income brackets at this point. And the researchers that I've talked to, and I haven't talked to one in probably about a year or so about this, so it's always worth rechecking as the research on this evolves over time. But everyone I've talked to on this point has basically said filtering works for middle income people. So if, you know, a new luxury subdivision is built at Copper River or Riverstone or Tesoro Viejo, the people that are moving into the homes that those people are moving into are not necessarily people who are making less than $50,000 a year. Those are people that are middle class that were, oh, great, I get to move into Woodward Park neighborhood in a Northeast Fresno school district, or I get to move into South Clovis. This is not working class, lower income people. And so filtering doesn't necessarily, it's not a sped up process.
Yeah, and I think the problem there is looking at the rental market as a one entity,
right,
opposed to seeing sets of rental markets or tranches where
right,
there's different people are operating in a different sector almost. And I think just looking at an overall rental market maybe obscures that.
The city has actually done some studies on this because they understand, people who are housing experts, people who are urban planners, understand that the housing market is not one, but like you were saying, it's segmented into people who are in different stages of life or have different housing needs. And what their study found, this was a study that came out as part of the mayor's One Fresno Housing Strategy, gosh, maybe 2 or 3 years ago. I can't remember, Pablo, if you reported on this, but that we have actually overbuilt the number of single family homes in Fresno, in part because the people who have the highest housing demand are people at the lower end of the income spectrum. And we've built what we need for middle and upper income people in Fresno. We have enough of that, but we haven't built what people need at the lower end of the spectrum.
Yeah. Let's circle back to you now, Pablo. Talk about pandemic funding. A lot of that's come to an end. What's that going to affect?
Yeah. So historically, this city and a lot of cities across the country have used that pandemic funding to fund some pretty creative solutions to help people throughout the coronavirus pandemic and the quarantines that followed. Here in the city in particular, the American Rescue Plan Act funds, or ARPA, funded programs like the Eviction Protection Program, the Emergency Rental Assistance Program, and the Voucher Incentive Program. And now only the Emergency Protection Program exists, and that's only just been getting funded by city funds. Those other two programs fell by the wayside. And here at the state level, the state increased funding from the pandemic towards some housing projects, namely through the Homeless Housing Assistance Program, which the city has used historically to purchase motels and hotels to turn into shelters, which will then be converted one day into affordable housing. But that's also starting to come down to an end, as in the 26th fiscal year, the budget the governor signed showed it will be $0 in HAP money And then in the 27 fiscal year, they're only going to get half of that money that were initially promised. So it's very clear that as we move further and further away from the pandemic, that a lot of the abundant bank, if you will, that the federal and state bankrolled for these cities to fund these homeless and housing programs is starting to come to an end.
And what are we seeing locally as a result of those coming funding cuts for homelessness?
Just last week, the Fresno Housing Authority announced that two of the shelters that they help operate, Journey Home and Golden State Triage Center, will be shutting down at the end of this year. At the end of this month, they'll stop taking in new residents, and residents have been given a bit of a runway until the end of the year to understand that at the end of the year, they will be closed. And normally these shelters do close anyway. Part of the state funding, the requirements that came with it was that one day shelters would be closed to be converted into affordable housing. But this is a situation where the funding has dried up to the point where these motels are closing, or rather these shelters are closing, simply because there are no operating funds left. So there's going to be a bit of a gap between when the shelters close to be converted and to where they'll just sit vacant, where people cannot go because operating funds have dried out. And it looks like this might be the first of a couple if the forecasted cuts to the state budget are what they look like they're going to be.
And that conversion is contingent on getting funds that the city doesn't currently have to convert those to affordable housing, correct?
Correct. These conversions can cost anywhere up to about $50 million. The city would probably tell you, as would many cities across the state, that a lot of times they really need these funds to actually even partake in a conversion. And the city officials told us that two applications are pending for both these shelters to eventually be converted, but they're just that, right? They're pending. And they might not come in time before the shelter can be closed. So we're now reaching a moment where, because pandemic funds have dried up, these shelters here, which are a very valuable and last stop resource for a lot of people before they go into homelessness, are starting to close down and come to an end.
And it's not necessarily a one-to-one. If you're in the shelter and it becomes affordable housing, you get to stay, right? Like, you have to vacate as they convert the housing, and then you're not guaranteed a spot, as I understand, into the new home.
Correct. A lot of these shelters, they'll either put one or maybe even two people per room, so that's how they can house as many people as they do. But when these shelters get converted into affordable housing, a lot of times it's not just studios. They're one bedroom, two bedroom, three bedrooms. So a lot of these rooms that were essentially for one person when they were shelters get converted into three spots now are for one person. So a shelter that might have housed 100 units now might only be about 64. So even the same amount of people that were in that shelter, who my understanding is they get first refusal for those new units, if they all accept it, there's still a scenario where many of those people that are in that shelter are still left without a unit.
Wow. Speaking of lost funds, the city lost its pro-housing status, according to a state board. Can you talk about how that will affect funding for housing going forward?
Yeah. So the pro-housing designation is a program that the state gives, and it's essentially a status or a title given by state housing officials to congratulate local jurisdictions for doing their part to cut red tape as it relates to building more affordable housing and doing their part to address their local jurisdiction's housing needs. And the city recently announced, I believe it was last month, through the mayor at a city council meeting, that they had lost this designation. Now, the designation is important because many of these state grants that we talked about that the city uses to convert shelters into affordable housing or to fund other housing or homelessness programs, a prerequisite to even apply for these is to have a pro-housing designation. So now we're reaching a point where, as these programs continue to be announced and millions of dollars continue to be shelled out from the state to local cities and counties, the city of Fresno is looking like they can't even apply for them. And so we're going to be looking at a length of time. It's going to take a couple months before they can get back that status. And by the mayor's own announcement, it looks like the state lawmakers want to give them that status back. But it'll take some time for them to meet the prerequisites it takes to get that status back.
What are those prerequisites? What do they need to do?
It's basically policies that would have the city eliminate barriers to building housing in places where office zone districts, okay, eliminating some parking requirements for certain types of housing. So it's all like elimination of regulatory barriers.
Red tape. Got
yeah.
It. Okay.
Yeah. We're seeing, Pablo, this loss of a lot of funding or a lot of jeopardizing of funding. How, you've been talking to homelessness advocates, how are they seeing the coming cliff that's coming?
Many of them are looking at it pretty existentially. Even if more state funding comes in the future, or the city is in the works behind the scenes of creating some sort of creative solution to these problems, what we know now is we're hitting the edge of this cliff pretty soon. And so they should start acting like it. So many homeless advocates or people that are on the ground in these camps are already trying to band together and see what they could do. But for many, there really is no solution. Going back to these people who might lose their vouchers, many of the people who have this might be forced to go back into a very dangerous situation if you are someone who is escaping a domestic violence issue. And so really, at this point, the talk among advocates and among people on the ground is that it's more of a countdown on when this issue is going to be exacerbated.
And it's a quagmire because you have the anti-camping ordinances and then you have a reduction in the number of beds. And so then it's a question of hot potato. Where do they go? Do they get processed in the criminal justice system? Who's gonna take these people on?
Yeah. Not a great solution. And I've seen from some, not folks in Fresno as much, but national people who are trying to stay remotely optimistic, is no one, I think where there's agreement across the political spectrum is no one thinks our affordable housing system works right now. It's incredibly expensive to build housing. You have to get so many different funding sources to make it work. The cost of building is really high. The bureaucratic barriers for people navigating the system is difficult. And so some people I've seen on the left are like, the cuts are really bad and maybe we can rethink how the system works. But that's very optimistic view of the situation. And so are there any solutions being thrown out locally to redirect towards some positive direction so that people, the homelessness rates just don't climb pretty significantly?
I guess my response to that would be those things take time. Even if Journey Home and Golden State Triage Center were approved today to start having ground broken to be converted into affordable housing, that's optimistically could take a calendar year. And so that's a whole calendar year, maybe a couple of months if you want to start in December, where people are left on the street to figure it out until they can find a unit. For our story where we talked to, where we reported on Both Their Shoulders Closing, we had an interview with a man named Jason Throop, who came to the shelter the same day I went to go talk to residents. And he's coming in a day after it was announced that these shelters are closing. And he spent a year trying to get into that spot. And so what do we tell people like him who checked all the boxes he needed to, did what he was supposed to, did what he was told to get a shelter space? And the day he comes in, we let him know that, hey, if this is a stopgap solution, with by the end of the year, you got to find another place again.
Yeah.
Yeah, there really is no easy answer for these people.
Yeah.
And I know there's movement at the state level, and Donnie and I have referenced the abundance movement before, but it's this kind of idea that decreasing the red tape, decreasing kind of the legal challenges to build affordable housing could increase housing stock. But there's always this long runway before ideation and then implementation actually go through. And so while a lot of these ideas are great, it's going to take time to implement them, and they're going to run into all sorts of obstacles. There's just a lot of challenges to actually change the system.
And I would say Fresno, unlike a lot of other California cities, has been more on the forefront in many ways of eliminating red tape. And although the city recently lost its pro-housing status, but they have made by-right zoning for certain types of housing available in lots of parts of the city. There was a bill that went through the legislature, at the end of June, that eliminated CEQA, which is like the environmental clearance that projects have to go through, so that to make housing projects a lot easier. The developers that Pablo and I have talked to have basically said, great, thanks so much for something that is not going to be useful to us at all. And thanks so much, Sacramento, for eliminating red tape, but it's actually not the problem that we have. Yeah. It's just really expensive to build in Fresno. And interestingly, so there's been this conversation in Sacramento for the last few years about how to accelerate affordable housing production. And the state at one point said, we're going to step in and be a developer, and we're going to use our land that we own to build a bunch of affordable housing to show how to get it done. And the site that they chose in Fresno, is there's not been any progress. So it's across the street from Target on Shields. And
they have a little sign brought to you by the state of California.
No. Yeah. There's a lot of barriers. And
I know Gavin Newsom's been saying, let's get some results. I think that's maybe more with his election cycle in mind rather than anything.
He is campaigning
practical.
In South Carolina right now. There's the people of South Carolina to consider. So all of this to say, thank you so much for your effort in Sacramento policymakers, but maybe you should come to Fresno and see what would actually change.
What
things.
A market failure it looks like.
Yeah.
So one experiment that's going on that actually just rolled out in June of this year is the city of San Jose is designating a sanctioned encampment zone where they're allowing people, and I think what I read was about 56 people can live on this site that's sanctioned by the city. So it's essentially an encampment that's been approved, and According to the San Jose Spotlight, that's going to cost about $2 million a year to operate this. I don't know if this has practical value in Fresno because we have a very different climate. There's a lot of challenges here. But I know these experiments are ongoing. Donnie, do you think that's something that could have legs, something like that for the city of Fresno? Because in theory, they wouldn't have to build anything. They could just designate an area.
Yeah. Des Martinez, who runs a nonprofit called We Are Not Invisible, she's probably the leading local homelessness advocate here in Fresno, or advocate for the homeless, I should say. This is an idea that she's been putting forward many times over the last several years. It's been reported on occasionally as different efforts that she's tried has popped up. And city leaders, to a certain extent, have tried to take it seriously. I think there was a delegation that went out to Texas to look at how this worked in Austin, perhaps. And Pablo, you can probably speak to the particulars of this, but there's been, I think, liability is a concern for them. Mm-hmm. If the city owns the property, just what is their responsibility? What isn't?
Could you say Chinatown is a de facto sanction zone in some ways if homeless people are congregating around that area of the city?
I think business owners in Chinatown will certainly say so.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you said, it would cost $2 million for the city of San Jose to run that. But here in the city of Fresno, it costs us about $1.5 million to run a homeless shelter. So it is a bit of an increase. Perhaps the math gets a bit better if you compare San Jose to Fresno. But there's a lot of logistic issues that the city would have to solve, both in terms of liability, insurance, who actually operates that shelter. But not only that, but I'm sure what you may have found looking at that San Jose shelter is that many of the neighboring residents and businesses are already complaining and maybe having some concerns about that shelter being where it is. And I would not be shocked to know that anywhere where a city-sanctioned shelter might be floated, the neighboring residents and businesses here would also have something to say about that.
So Donnie, we have at the end of this calendar year a sunset on funding and available resources. Do you anticipate the city's just going to wait until there's a crisis and then address it? With your experience working with the city over years,
I know that where there is funding, they will chase it. And as Pablo mentioned, they're already in the process of trying to find additional funds to be able to convert the two shelters that are closing into permanent housing. So the city is good at chasing money when they can get it, and they will continue to do that. But there's this other question about when the funding that they can chase dries up, what do you do? And what we've seen in other cities is San Francisco, LA, I believe San Diego, I'm not sure about San Jose. A lot of them have gone either to their local voters to say, housing is a big enough issue that we think we should add a tax. I have no idea if Fresno will ever touch that with a 10-foot pole. It seems politically fraught, but a lot of things are politically fraught in Fresno, and we still do them. And so that Fresno is one of, if you look at its housing budget in the budget process, almost 95% perhaps of the city's affordable housing funds come from the federal and state. And so they're not using a lot of their own local money to fund shelters, to fund affordable housing. There is some local money that's going into it. Want to give credit where credit's due, but not a lot. And so whether they want to have conversations about establishing a more permanent source of funding is, I think, something that should be at least discussed.
Yeah. How does the county play into this? Do they have any role in, I know that they can often be at other ends of a discussion in terms of their perspective on solutions, but how can they interact potentially to work to solve some of these problems?
I think similarly, this is and part of the problem in Fresno is that the city and the county have had very siloed conversations about homelessness and affordable housing. And we've seen a little bit of movement now that Luis Chavez, formerly a city council member, now on the Board of Supervisors, is over there at the county. And I know he's been trying to bridge the two entities better so that they can look at how does their funding complement the city's funding and vice versa. But any long-term solution really does need to have the county at the table, because the county is the one that runs behavioral health departments and mental health supports. And homelessness is such
a conduit to help people.
Right. Yeah. And it doesn't make sense for the city to do it all on its own, and it doesn't make sense for the county to do it all on its own. But
I could foresee just less enforcement of anti-camping ordinances as our county jail fills. Where are you going to put people? So we could just see a return to status quo in some ways, which is not good for anybody, but that's probably the cheapest solution for the city.
Certainly. But I hope that's not where we go.
I hope not either. So we close these podcasts every week with what we're loving this week. Pablo, what are you loving this hot Fresno summer?
Gosh, what I'm loving? I saw Superman last Thursday in IMAX in a very packed theater, and I think everybody in that room really had a fun time. I would say we were loving that.
So it's like it's a restart, right, to Superman. I'll be honest, when I watched some of the trailers, it looked a little cheesy. Was it cheesy? Was it funny? Because I know it's the same director as Guardians of the Galaxy, and he likes to have mix in humor with the kind of traditional superhero movie.
Yeah, I think if you like those films, you're going to love this one. I think it's a little more reined in. To your point, it's an introduction, so you don't want to really throw people in the deep end with that. But yeah, I think it's it tries to be very funny while balancing the fact that it's a very earnest film about a doing the right thing, being a superpower.
Pablo, I know you're a big movie guy. What is your go-to movie theater snack?
Man, I like an ice cream.
Ice cream?
I don't like having a snack for the duration of the film, say popcorn, where I'm just constantly having to babysit it throughout the runtime.
You don't want to be distracted.
I actually like eating most of my snacks before the film even starts.
Oh, wow. So you get it in and then you have your full concentration.
Oh, I'll take a drink to have maybe sip on throughout the film. But in terms of an actual food or a meal, just give me something like an ice cream where I can kill it in 5 minutes and then we can actually focus on a movie.
Wow.
Donnie, what about you? When you go to concessions at a movie theater, what catches your eye?
Well, first of all, I was not allowed to have movie snacks as a child.
Oh, deprivation.
Oh, wow. My household growing up, it was special. Popcorn.
Popcorn.
Yeah. Simple.
You do a lot of butter on that?
Yeah. Or I really like to bring my own popcorn because I like the popcorn that I make at home better than the movie theater.
Yeah.
So sometimes I'll bring my own little Ziploc bags.
Gotcha. Mine recently has been these awful things that I'm sure I don't ever want to look at the ingredients. They're called nerd clusters.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. They're so good.
Dude, there's like a weird nerd cluster craze right now. I'm not sure how to explain
They're so good. It's just you got the nerds on the outside and that gummy on the inside. Oof.
Yeah.
What are you loving this week, Donnie?
I finally broke down and bought a stand-up paddleboard.
Ooh.
I know, an inflatable one because I don't have a rack on my car. And I've gone a couple of times before buying one, and then I tested it out this weekend, and I was like, all right, I'm going to stand up.
Yeah.
And then I ate it really bad. And
is it harder to balance on an inflatable one?
It is.
Okay.
It is. So I didn't really realize that because I think I've mostly paddleboarded on not inflatable ones. So I'm going to have to get better at my balance. I'm also 40 now, so my 30-year-old body is just, I don't have that anymore. So I have to reconcile with reality, but I'm determined to get on the river this summer and continue to try until I can do it consistently.
Very nice.
I work in public education, and so summertime is the time for that summer break. And I love getting lost in a big novel, and I actually did the opposite this year. I got lost in a small novel. I don't normally read Anne Tyler. She had this little kind of small book come out. It's called 3 Days in June. But some like simple, like domestic drama was exactly what I needed. And so I've just been enjoying the kind of little bit of cool that we have on those summer mornings and just sitting out in the front yard of my house and reading a book.
Oh, perfect.
That's been just so relaxing and just taking my mind off of all the chaos in the world and all the things going on for just a little bit in the morning and escaping to her domestic scene in Baltimore has been everything I've needed these past couple weeks.
Do you sip on or snack on anything while you read?
So if I'm reading in the morning, I'm a super coffee nerd, and so I usually have my oat milk cortado, which I'm lifting my pinky finger up. You can't see this right now, but that's what I'm doing. So that's usually my go-to drink while I'm reading a book in the morning. This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan. And our song comes from Stateless Rat.